It's primary day in New Jersey and the final Super Tuesday of the election season. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. In South Jersey's 1st District, a battle is nearing the end between incumbent Congressman Donald Norcross and political newcomer Alex Law. Democrats there are also taking sides in the presidential primary, where Hillary Clinton has reportedly garnered enough delegates to clinch the nomination, although Bernie Sanders supporters are still turning out to vote. WHYY's Joe Hernandez visited one polling place in Collingswood.
There was a steady stream of voters outside the Scottish Rite Auditorium late this morning. One was Keith Winstrup, who says he cast his vote for Hillary Clinton, but his endorsement was only lukewarm.
The lesser of two evils, I don't know. Bernie Sanders isn't who he says he is, you know. I like Hillary. I hate Trump. This devil. It's the lesser of the three poisons, actually, this year. It's a pretty bad voting year.
Winstrup also picked incumbent Donald Norcross, a former electrician, for the 1st District congressional seat. But others came out in support of Democratic congressional candidate Alex Law, the former tech consultant whose platform closely mirrors Sanders. Collingswood resident Tim O'Neill voted for both Law and Sanders.
Bernie has the same platform as FDR's Second Bill of Rights, which is economic justice, single-payer health care, a decent living wage, and also... Thank you, brother. Feel the burn. Feel the burn.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has already secured enough support to win his party's nomination. In the 1st District, Republican congressional candidate Bob Patterson is running unopposed. Another race to look out for tonight is the Democratic primary in the 3rd District, which covers large parts of Burlington and Ocean counties. There, tavern owner Jim Keedy and former loan officer Fred Laverne are competing for the chance to take on first-term Republican Tom MacArthur in the fall. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
We are some 7 weeks out from the Thrilla in Philla. Now, this disclosure, that's not my name for the DNC. It's the title from the latest Political Junkie newsletter. And for that, let's go to the source. Joining me is Ken Rudin. Ken, thanks for being here on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
You've been at this a long time. For a political junkie, does the junk get any purer than this election cycle?
You know something? Every 4 years, we always say we've never seen anything like this, but that is so true in 2016. We've never seen a candidate like Donald Trump. Every time he crosses a line, every time he says something either offensive or incendiary or outrageous, we say, okay, this time he's gone too far. And it keeps happening, and his numbers keep increasing. And then on the Democratic side, I mean, how rare is it for the battle to go on all the way to June? I mean, we saw that with Obama and Clinton in 2008, but it's rare. Both parties have surprised us completely this year.
Each day brings new surprises. Among the ones from today, Paul Ryan this morning said that Trump's assessment of the federal judge trying his case is a textbook definition of racism. Yet, he's still backing Donald Trump for president. What kind of signal does that send to the swing voters who likely determine the result come November?
I'll tell you what it does for the Republican Party. They are tearing their hair over this because there are so many Republicans like Marco Rubio, like Paul Ryan, like many others who'd rather not have endorsed Donald Trump. But for Paul Ryan, maybe he's looking at 2020. Maybe he just wants a united Republican Party so they'll keep control of the House in 2016. But whatever it is, it was torturous to watch Paul Ryan try to explain that, yes, it was a racist comment that Donald Trump made about the judge, but no, we have to defeat Hillary Clinton, so I'm not retracting my support for Donald Trump. Look, Donald Trump is not their ideal candidate, to say the least. He's saying things that is very likely to alienate the demographic groups and voters that the Republicans desperately need, but he's their guy and they're stuck with him, barring some shocker in Cleveland.
Hey, what's this fiction you're talking about, a united Republican Party or a united Democratic Party? Have parties been fractured like this since you've been at it?
Well, yes, they have. I mean, we have seen things, certainly, I mean, you have to go back a bit, but Barry Goldwater, of course, in 1964, did not have a united Republican Party behind him. Nelson Rockefeller, Bill Scranton, governor of Pennsylvania, George Romney, others, Hugh Scott, they were not Barry Goldwater supporters and fans in 1964. But we've never seen an election with both major party presidential candidates with more unfavorables than favorables. It's just remarkable. Now, I don't know how that changes with Donald Trump, because Donald Trump said, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing and I'm not going to change. And of course, that's not what Republicans want to hear. There's still raw emotion between the Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton forces. He's still saying that he can win over superdelegates. He still thinks that this will be a contested convention. That may be the case, but, you know, this is June 7th and not November 7th. So I think the Democratic Party has a much likelier opportunity to unite before the general election than the Republicans do.
You know, one of the tenets of Poli-Sci 101 is that as it gets closer to Election Day, you tend to move toward the middle. But we see seemingly the opposite. Bernie Sanders is the tail that's wagging the Democratic dog, and Donald Trump is, well, Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think, I mean, that was an old famous Richard Nixon quote, that as a Republican, you run to the right in the primaries and then you move to the center in the general election. Mitt Romney tried to do that in 2012, but it was just so patently transparent that it just didn't work. But Hillary Clinton is basically that candidate. She has liberal positions on many issues, but I think she's inherently a centrist candidate.
The polls are open for several more hours in California, and yet we do know that Hillary Clinton has crossed that magic 2383 delegate count. If Bernie were to prevail this evening, what might you guess the thrilla in Philla would look like?
If he wins California, he'll once again try to make the case to the superdelegates that he will do much better against Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton would. He's going to say, look, as far as I know, right now, she has not gotten over 2383, because that number includes the superdelegates who will cast their ballots at the convention, and they're not bound by anything. So whether he wins the nomination or not, whether he woos over the superdelegates or not, he still has a lot to say about the future of the Democratic Party, and he's going to make it clear that he's going to battle all the way to Philadelphia.
Hey, Ken, if past is prologue, all she really needs to do is make him Secretary of State.
Right. We did see that once before, didn't we?
We did. Thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Dave, thank you.
Political junkie Ken Rudin. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org and check out the Political Junkie podcast at krpoliticaljunkie.com. For only the second time, the women of Philadelphia City Council have collaborated to advance a package of bills. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that they're focused on eliminating health risks from lead.
The councilwomen plan to introduce legislation aimed at protecting Philadelphia children from lead exposure. Councilwoman Helen Gims says the city's been increasingly conscious of lead paint poisoning for years, but the issues in Flint, Michigan have highlighted potential problems in drinking water.
While our city has made admirable progress addressing the dangers of lead paint, the package of bills will take this even a step farther by enacting new regulations to ensure that schools and child care centers adhere to strict lead testing requirements and that all landlords and property sellers disclose the presence of lead water service lines.
Councilwoman Janie Blackwell says the school testing provision is paramount.
Because children eat, many of them eat their main meals in school, and so we have to have water that is safe for them to drink. So this is an idea whose time has long since come, and we have to work hard. I know part of the biggest challenge is going to be enforcement.
Councilwoman Cindy Bass says an earlier council hearing on the dangers of lead poisoning motivated her to call for expanding regulations on lead paint disclosure.
I walked in with one mindset and walked away with a completely different idea based on the information that was presented by the water department. I was quite disturbed, I have to say.
Hearings on the measures probably won't occur until council returns from its summer recess in the fall. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
A survey of Pennsylvania superintendents and school business officials offers a bleak portrait of the state of education in the Commonwealth. As Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCoy reports, widespread staffing cuts and property tax hikes are anticipated.
With mandated costs growing faster than revenues, representatives of districts across the state say they are planning to cut staff, increase class sizes, and curtail programs and extracurriculars, all while hiking local property taxes. The Pennsylvania Association of School Administrators and Pennsylvania Association of School Business Officials have been conducting surveys since 2010 and say this year's offered the worst outlook. Jim Buckhite is the executive director of the Administrators Association.
I'm shocked at the level of how bad things have gotten, that we haven't turned a corner from the 2008 recession yet.
Buckhite estimates that on the whole, the cost of mandated expenses, such as pension payments, will rise by more than $600 million in the coming school year. 46% of districts report they will need to cut staff, 34% plan to increase class sizes, 50% plan to cut academic programs and extracurriculars, with the state's poorest districts affected most. At the same time, more districts plan to raise property taxes this year than last year, jumping from 71% to 85%. Again, Buckhite.
The gross inequities that exist in our funding of public schools in the state are only going to continue to widen unless these things, increases in state funding, state share of the cost of education, and some mandate relief is provided.
Pennsylvania ranks near the bottom of all states in the total share of education spending provided by the state. Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
Still ahead this evening, a Philadelphia startup has expanded to other cities and has plans to deliver to even more grateful consumers.
A lot of customers just like come up and give you a hug. Like, thanks for bringing me, you know, some Gatorade and beer. This is awesome.
Snacks on Demand when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. At a recent legal forum in Harrisburg, a prominent natural gas industry executive suggested that his company tries to avoid drilling near wealthy residents. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports the comments sparked a controversy that's shining a spotlight on the issue of environmental justice.
Suffice it to say, the comment did not go over very well with Patrick Grenter. He heads the Center for Coalfield Justice, an advocacy group based in southwestern Pennsylvania. Grenter was sitting in the room full of lawyers when he heard Terry Bossert of Range Resources suggest the company tries to avoid gas drilling near big houses where people may have the financial means to fight them.
Well, I was infuriated when I heard it. I mean, honestly, I was sitting with some colleagues and I said to them each, like, did he really just say that?
A few weeks later, Bossert issued an apology. He said he'd made a mistake by attempting to, quote, interject dry sarcasm at the event. Neither Bossert nor Range Resources would comment for this story. But the remark has put a renewed focus on the issue of environmental justice, meaning it's often poor and marginalized communities who end up bearing the brunt of industrial development. In Pennsylvania, an environmental justice, or EJ zone, is defined as a census tract where at least 20% of the people live in poverty and or at least 30% of the population is minority. Grenter thinks that's a good start.
We do think that those are two significant indicators that need to be valued, but also we think the discussion should be bigger.
For example, permit applications for some things like landfills or coal mines in EJ zones trigger more scrutiny from the State Department of Environmental Protection. But that's not the case with oil and gas permits. Kirk Jalbert is with the Pittsburgh-based Frack Tracker Alliance, a group that uses data analysis to track the risks of oil and gas development.
Over 9,600 unconventional oil and gas wells in Pennsylvania, only 5% of them exist within present environmental justice designated census tracts.
And that's because Pennsylvania's Marcellus shale boom has largely happened in rural areas where much of the population is white.
But if you start to look at other factors like poverty, for example, you'll find that a lot of those census tracts are also not over the poverty threshold, but they're right on the edge of working poor. They're right on the edge of people who you would consider marginalized.
Shirley and Bill Aiken certainly feel marginalized. Both are retired, now in their 80s. They live in rural Washington County, about 30 miles southwest of Pittsburgh. Their annual household income is around $27,000. And even so, Shirley says they're spending $100 every 6 weeks to fill up a massive water tank in their backyard.
This is our water buffalo. Yep, 2,500 gallon we have to buy.
The Akins began having problems with their well water around 2008. It was the same time gas drilling began near their home. Although there's no proof their water issues are connected to the gas development, the couple has been dealing with years of disruptions.
Quite a few times in the middle of the night, our alarms have gone off, and we've had the house shake.
Shirley says they're just too old to move at this point.
It's been 8 years. We're tired.
And even if they tried, she doesn't think anyone would want their house.
If you don't have water and good air, what do you have? Nothing.
After the controversy over the comment from the Range Resources executive, Kirk Jalbert at FrackTracker decided to delve into the issue. He built a map of gas wells in census tracts within a 3-county region around Pittsburgh. It includes urban, suburban, and rural communities.
And then what I did was I shaded these census tracts based on what their median home value was.
So what did he find? Well, there are 779 gas wells, and almost all of them are in census tracts where the median home value is below $200,000.
As soon as you get above that $200,000 threshold, there's only two wells total.
Jalbert is quick to point out that doesn't prove Range Resources or any other gas company deliberately avoids rich people and their big houses. For example, he says there's just a lot more room to work in rural areas. Also, wealthy people may simply be less inclined to lease their mineral rights because they don't need the money. Nevertheless, Patrick Grenter thinks the renewed focus on environmental justice is important.
The fact that we're having this discussion is important. These practices need to be brought to the light.
The Center for Coalfield Justice and two other groups sent a letter to the State Department of Environmental Protection asking it to take a closer look at environmental justice and gas development. They recently heard back from the DEP saying they're going to do just that. But this was a big priority for Secretary John Quigley, who recently resigned from the department amid disputes with Governor Tom Wolf's administration and the legislature. That development has Grenter a bit worried now.
Certainly, Secretary Quigley's resignation is a cause of concern for us. We have seen past administrations in Pennsylvania, both Democratic and Republican, completely fail on issues of environmental justice here.
It's not yet clear whether things will change much. The newly appointed head of DEP's Office of Environmental Justice wouldn't comment for this story. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
A local startup that delivers snacks and beer to your doorstep is raising money for a national expansion. From WHYY's Innovations Desk, Todd Bookman reports on GoPuff's big summer plans.
It's late at night. You've been hanging out. Maybe there's some Bob Marley playing on the hi-fi. You're jamming, but all of a sudden, the urge for munchies is real. Relax. GoPuff is there for you.
A lot of customers just like come up and give you a hug.
Rafael Ilyashaev co-founded GoPuff in 2014 while he was a student at Drexel University. Today, the online delivery service operates in 9 cities, offering convenience store staples like chips, ice cream, and Gatorade, but also beer, rolling papers, condoms, tampons, all at your doorstep within 30 minutes, even late night, for a $2 delivery fee. They rely on independent drivers, similar to Uber's employee model. And after recently raising $8 million in venture capital funding, the Philadelphia company is looking to go big.
We're going to be using to get a lot better and more qualified personnel, as well as expanding to as many cities as possible.
That means 4 additional markets this summer and 18 total by the end of the year. GoPuff is also tweaking their product lines to serve a wider audience.
A huge request for us right now is diapers.
Ilyashaev says the company is looking to operate enough distribution warehouses and hire enough drivers to get delivery times down to under 15 minutes. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
And finally this evening, the Philadelphia Zoo is getting a beer garden. A representative has told Philadelphia Magazine that formerly an alcohol-free zone, the zoo decided to open the garden after many patrons said they'd like to drink at the zoo. The beer garden will open next month under the name The Watering Hole. What's more, patrons will be permitted to take their drinks with them throughout the zoo. But remember, don't feed the animals applies to liquids, too.
Whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Stay with WHYY at 8 this evening following Fresh Air with NPR's live coverage of primary results from New Jersey to California. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Corruption and crime in the streets. It's time the long arm of the law.